Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Sat7, a Christian television station building bridges across the Middle East. And Cross International Catholic Outreach, a passionate belief in the power of the gospel to transform the lives of the poor. A voice for Christians in the Middle East and a bridge to the majority Muslim world. Those are the two goals of a Christian television station, Sat7, which has been broadcasting across the region for the past 15 years with educational, inspirational and above all entertaining programmes for young and old alike. Working ecumenically with all the Christian churches in the region, Sat7 has expanded significantly and has millions of Muslim viewers, as well as Muslim guests and hosts on most of its daily programming. Despite the many challenges and difficulties facing Christian communities in the region, Sat7 encourages people to stay and to engage across the political and religious divides, fostering bridges of understanding and cooperation through the daily dialogue of life.
Sat7 came out of the awareness that in the Middle East, 70% of the population have a satellite dish now. So satellite TV is the media that goes into almost every home.
Kurt Johansson, a Lutheran from Denmark, heads Sat7's European office. He told me more about the origins and the goals of this pioneering media network.
People in the Middle East watch us or listen more through television than anywhere else in the world. So we found that this is the first time in world history where we can actually go to so many millions of homes if we do it in a good way, if you make attractive programs. So we started 15 years ago with a small studio in Lebanon, and later we expanded with another studio in Egypt. And now, to make a long story short, we have five channels 24 hours a day in the three major languages of the Middle East, in Arabic, in Farsi for Iran, and Turkish for Turkey.
The vast majority of those millions of homes are all Muslims, aren't they?
Yeah, we are a voice by the Christians, and everyone has the choice to look at Sat7 or not. It seems that the majority of our viewers are non-Christians, or they are Muslims, but that's something they have decided to do.
You talk about, in your mission statement, you talk about one of the goals is to obviously educate and encourage the Christian community, but also to combat misconceptions about the Christian faith. What do you mean by that exactly?
There's a lot of misconceptions about the Christian faith, like we are cannibals because we have the Holy Communion, that we are immoral because men and women are sitting together in the churches, unlike in the mosques, and so on and so on. That we believe in three gods, not in one God. And all these things we can talk about that very openly on Sat7. And because all our staff are Middle East Christians who meet Muslims every day on the street, they can explain in a very relevant and appropriate way what are we Christians believing in. And thereby we can build bridges, we can eliminate misunderstandings, and we can give the church a kind of identity and legitimacy in the society.
So would you say that the majority of the programs are educational, or is there a wide variety of programming on Sat7?
All programs of Sat7 should fulfill three obligations. They should be entertaining, if not, no one will listen or watch them. They should be educational, you should learn something after watching a program. And they should also somehow have a Christian content. So we have all kinds of segments, all kinds of dimensions of a program, but somehow there should be these three dimensions of each program.
You also have a dedicated children's channel, don't you, a kids' channel?
We have a 24-hour kids' channel called Sat7 Kids. It's probably our most popular channel. Seems to have about 9 million daily viewers, most of them in countries like Iraq and Saudi Arabia. And this is one of the few kids' channels in the Middle East, and they seem to be very popular also in non-Christian homes because we don't have any violence, no hate promotion. I mean, only good values, and you can learn a lot from watching our programs.
It's an ecumenical foundation, isn't it?
Yeah, we work with all the churches of the Middle East, Orthodox, Catholic, Protestants, in all the 19 countries of the Middle East.
That's quite a challenge, given the difficulties often between the different churches, for example.
It is a challenge, but we have done so now for 15 years, and it seems to be possible. It's not easy, but it is possible. And we have done that and we will continue to do that.
It's a time of great uncertainty across that Middle East and North African region at the moment, particularly for Christians. Mm. We've seen so much violence perpetrated in the past few years in so many different countries. Are there risks involved in this kind of station?
I don't think we are at risk. We have never attacked any religion. We have never criticized any religion. We are not partial towards any political party. We have been now in the region for 15 years, and I think the local governments have learned about us now that we are here to build up the society, to improve the society, and to give the society a kind of pluralism that there are Christians, they should have a voice. We have a lot of current affairs programs where we also invite Muslims to talk. In fact, in every program we have a Muslim now, and many of the talk show hosts are Muslims. Many of those who call our live programs are Muslims. So we have found a way to be a voice for the Christians, but also to be a bridge for the non-Christian groups. I think there's a future for us. Of course, everything is open now, and of course, a lot of Christians are afraid of the future. 200,000 Christians left Egypt last year, and perhaps another 200,000 will leave this year. They don't see a future. But we like to use our station to tell the Christians that they should not leave, they should not retreat, they should involve. So we try to encourage them to involve in society, be light and salt, and to have a prophetic voice. There's a need for that. And I think the Christians have a lot to achieve, a lot to contribute to the societies of the Middle East right now.
And yet, faced with the kind of attacks we've seen on Christian churches in Egypt, previously in Iraq as well, it's understandable, isn't it, that people just want to go?
It's understandable that people want to go. On the other hand, we don't want to see the Middle East without Christians. So that's why we have a kind of campaign right now called Stay in Your Country, where a lot of people tell their stories. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, we had a difficult time. But this is our area, this is our vocation, this is where we want to stay and where our forefathers lived, and we will live here as well.
You talked about the situation in Iraq, where there has been a decrease in attacks on Christians specifically. Tell us a bit more about this.
Yeah, there was a conference between the Christian leaders and the Muslim leaders, where the Muslim leaders agreed to issue a fatwa, a Muslim order, that Christians should be left in peace, should not be attacked. It was, in fact, a crime against Islam to attack Christians. So after that fatwa, the number of attacks had gone down a lot. For some months, there were no attacks on Christians. And still, it seems like it's improving a lot in Iraq at the moment.
This conference was in January 2011, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was held in Copenhagen. It couldn't be held in Iraq. It was too dangerous. So the Danish Minister of Foreign Affairs invited them to Copenhagen under the leadership of Canon Andrew White from Baghdad, and they were able to negotiate peacefully and in a good atmosphere in Copenhagen, and then go back to Iraq and issue this fatwa.
It seems to be an extraordinary example of the way interfaith dialogue actually has had a concrete effect on the political situation there. Mm. Doesn't happen very often, does it?
No, it doesn't happen very often. It takes a lot of hard work to visit, to talk with a lot of different leaders, to bring them together. And it needs extraordinary people to do that. And maybe we haven't seen too many of this leadership so far, but it's a good example, and we hope that can spread to countries like Syria or Egypt, where Christians are also at risk at this time.
Do you think this kind of experiment can be repeated?
It can, but it needs some persons who want to invest in it and who have already invested a lot of it, because you can't do that overnight. You have to spend month after month talking and visiting and get the credibility in among all these leaders. It's difficult, but it can be done and it should be done.
What is the atmosphere at the moment in Egypt? We've seen the elections and so on.
I think the Christians have this attitude, wait and see. They're not very happy. But on the other hand, this is the situation and let's get the best out of it. I was in Beirut last week and met two or three of the Egyptian church leaders who the day before was invited to the new president of Egypt. They were also invited to be part of the group that is writing the new constitution. So at least there are Christians in the group writing the new constitution. And also the president have declared that he want a Christian vice president. So let's try to be involved. Let's try to be optimistic. Let's try to see what's happened.
Pope Benedict is, of course, traveling to Lebanon in the autumn. Do you think a visit like that can do anything to improve the situation there?
Surely it will create more international attention on the situation. It will make more attention for the Christians, more awareness, and that is always good. So I'm very hopeful for the Pope to go there. I'm praying for his visit that it will be a success. I can add that we just recently had the first live program from Iraq where we were able to broadcast a lot of good things happening in Iraq and also talk about difficulties like the sad events on New Year's Eve a year and a half ago where 100 Christians were killed. A lot of people were asking why did not God intervene in that situation? Why did not a miracle happen? And some of those who were outside the church said that a real miracle that day was that all the Christians were offered the opportunity to convert to Islam to save their lives. None of them did that. That was a miracle that day.
My thanks there to Kurt Johansson, head of SAT7's European office. A passion for the poor and a belief in the power of the gospel to transform people's lives. Those are the two founding principles of a Florida-based charity called Cross International Catholic Outreach, founded just over a decade ago to help fund existing aid projects across the developing world. Cross currently supports innovative programs for the poorest of the poor in Africa, Asia, South America, and the Caribbean.
We began in 2001. Our vision was to provide aid to the Church's Ministry of Charity that is already there.
Jim Kavnar is president of Cross International Catholic Outreach, which counts 7 U.S. bishops on its board of directors. He was in Rome recently for a visit to the Vatican's charitable agency, Cor Unum, with which Cross has been cooperating closely for the past few years. On this occasion, Jim told me he was sharing ideas about the role of charitable giving in promoting both new evangelization and the forthcoming Year of Faith, scheduled to begin in October of this year. For Jim himself, the event will bring back powerful memories of the previous Year of Faith, called for by another pope back in the summer of 1967. Jim Kavanagh, welcome back to our Vatican Radio studios.
Very good to be with you again.
You're here talking about the work of your organization, Cross International Catholic Outreach. You're talking about it also in terms of the upcoming Year of Faith, aren't you, which had a particular poignancy for you. Just remind us of your own connection with the Year of Faith.
I very clearly remember a Year of Faith that began on June 29th, 1967. It was the summer that I had graduated from college, University of Notre Dame in the U.S., and it was the year that 4 of us who had met one another there got together and spent that summer praying and talking to people and seeking God for where we would go and work. And it was on that day that we made decisions, and decisions were made for us that led to our working together in Ann Arbor, Michigan for 25 years. We still work together in ministry. We're in different cities now, but we're on each other's boards of directors, and we're all engaged in one way or another with evangelization. And the Ministry of Cross Catholic Outreach is focused upon Ministry of Charity, and yet we've always sought out those ministries of charity that incorporate appropriate evangelization. And so when I hear about a Year of Faith, I can't help but reflect on what happened back in 1967.
Certainly it was a Year of Faith that has borne fruit in your life ever since.
And we certainly experienced it as a Year of Faith. We were stepping out in faith with, you might say, no visible means of support at that time, and yet trusting God. And the steps we took beginning on that very day, you know, transformed our lives and led to what we've done for the last 45 years.
Just remind us a little bit of the history of Cross, what it does, how it all began.
We began in 2001. Our vision was to provide aid to the Church's Ministry of Charity that is already there in developing countries, not to send Americans to create new works, but to look for those that already there, you know, bishops and priests and nuns and lay organizations that are already there effectively meeting the needs of the poor but lacking resources. And the priority was always there for us, look for those that also effectively share the Word of God. And now, in recent years, that's become even more significant to us. It's always been a priority. But particularly the awareness of the new evangelization has caused us to reflect on it more. And in fact, this year also begins our latest 5-year strategic plan. And the number one objective is to grow stronger in our ability to provide aid to those that reflect the Church's ministry of charity effectively, but also incorporate appropriate evangelization.
What does that mean to you at Cross? What does it mean, the new evangelization, through your work?
It means looking for those that recognize that the most effective way we can help people is to bring about true transformation. Now, when you talk about transformation of the poor, most often in that context, people think about helping them become more self-sufficient, help them become less dependent on handouts, more able to provide for themselves. But we also recognize that the most effective transformation comes about when God is part of it. And we see this all the time around the world. I was in the Philippines last year and visited some of the ministries we support there. They work in the slums of the Philippines. And they told us, they said, you know, we can rebuild the houses, we can change the externals, and we can create a nicer place to live. But unless we change the hearts and minds and relationships of the people, it will all be a slum in 2 or 3 years. And that's why they ran programs for every age group, preschool, young children, teenagers, young adults, married couples, to lead them closer to Christ, to involve them in prayer and sharing their lives as Christians, to evangelize them, taking the adults on retreats that they call Encountering Christ retreats. And they say that has resulted in a transformation of the people from being kind of isolated people to being joined together, supporting one another, meeting in their homes, talking about the Lord. And the result has been that the material transformation has truly produced human transformation. And because of the spiritual component, the man who told me, if we don't transform the people's hearts, minds, and attitudes, this will all be a slum, could also point to the fact that 45 of the people in that community had just walked out of having prayer meeting together that morning to launch their day, and that we could go to places that had been transformed physically 5 years before, and they were pristine because the people were transformed. Not just physically, but emotionally, spiritually, they were changed.
Philippines, of course, an extremely Catholic country, the most Catholic country in Asia. You're also working in contexts where the church is not such a huge majority.
Well, I was thinking of a particular location in Haiti. One of the missions that we support there, led by a Catholic priest there, when he came there, it was because the local bishop said, this is the darkest corner of Haiti. It is spiritually dark because it's totally dominated by voodoo. It is materially dark because it is the poorest place in the country. We have been supporting his ministry since 2003, but he's been there for 23 years. Today, there is no voodoo. The voodoo priests all got converted by him, and they're now all Catholics. There is hundreds of people with new houses and a plot of land where they've learned to grow crops and sell some to help support themselves. There are 2,400 children in Catholic schools being supported, and the lunches that they eat every day, the food is being purchased from those people who got the houses, so they learn to farm and they learn to sell some of their produce. And today, you see a completely transformed community. It is spiritually transformed in that there is no longer any dominance of voodoo superstition, and instead, the church is at the center. And all these children are being raised as Catholic children. it is materially transformed because you've got 600 families with new houses. You have a microfinance program that is helping people start little businesses. You've got a program for the very, very destitute who can't support themselves, very elderly, etc., who receive monthly supplies of food and toiletries. And these are all things that we've supported. In fact, we're increasing our support even more because it does reflect such a remarkable, true transformation materially and spiritually, and they go together. And he would be the first to say so.
This is a very good story coming out of Haiti, which is still struggling, isn't it, to recover from the devastating earthquake?
Yeah, the January 2010 earthquake left 1.5 million people homeless. Today, there's still 200,000 to 300,000 in tents, many more in transitional housing, that is more permanent housing, but not truly permanent. It's still extremely poor. The earthquake certainly set things back. But this very place that I just described, Cobinal, Haiti, is 2.5 hours drive away from the capital. But thousands of people left the capital and went back there because their families had lived there. They maybe had lived there at one time. Now there was no job in the capital. There was, you know, their homes were gone. And so a lot of our earthquake reconstruction has been in places like that to build new houses for families moving in there and need to be reintegrated into their old community.
A lot of your work is advocacy in the United States, isn't it? Raising funds to support this extraordinary work that you're doing in different countries around the world.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that side of things.
We have 45, almost 50 priests now who represent us in parishes, and they go around and they preach at all the masses in parishes. Maybe 1,000 to 1,300 a year parishes will host some of our priests coming in. We see this as very important. The Catholic Church in the U.S. has sort of lost that sense of the missions. When I was a child growing up in the church, Catholic grade school, you heard about the missions all the time. You know, they don't hear much about it. And instead, they hear about all the problems in the church. And so when our priests come in and then when they get our literature and things like that, it brings hope because it says, well, this is what the church ought to be doing. This is the side of the church that we love. And so it's an inspiration to people. And it also gives them a tangible way to be involved in the missions because they can give funds and they know that this is going to go through a Catholic mission of some kind and it will have results and that they're going to hear about the results because we're very, very good at communicating between the Church of the Poor and the Church in the U.S. and enabling the Church in the U.S. to see the impact of their support and to learn and grow from the faith of the poor, whose faith often shames ours, frankly.
Even now, in times of great difficulties, recession, uncertainty, are you still finding that people have this generous side to them when they hear about what their money can do in other countries?
Yeah, it's been interesting. When the recession began in late 2008, we wondered what would happen. What happened was that when our priests would go in, the same percentage of people still gave. The amount they gave was 10 or 15% less because people had a little less money. But the will was there, and people gave to the best of their ability. And despite the recession, every year our ministry has grown 25% a year, all during the recession. Even before that, it was even more rapid, but it just shows that the generosity in the heart is there, even in difficult times, and people give what they can. And so we've seen a wonderful growth.
What do you see as the biggest challenges for your organization today?
Well, I think we have a spiritual challenge to remain true to what God called us to do. I think it's one of the reasons that in our strategic plan, the very first objective was to strengthen our ability to really reflect the church's full ministry to the poor, which is what, as the popes call it, integral human development, addressing the integral needs of the whole man, spiritual. And I think we realize as we grow, as we get bigger, we have to be effective in carrying forward that spiritual vision. So we're actually trying to make it stronger rather than allow it to become weak. I think another big challenge is, in fact, going to be growth because of the economies. It's affecting the U.S., it's affecting Europe, and overseas the effect is even worse. In poor countries, for example, we send them perhaps the same amount of money in U.S. dollars, but it buys less. Cost of food goes up, value of the dollar or the euro goes down, and it's much harder for them overseas. So there are many stresses that they're communicating to us that they're under, and we're very committed to seeing that they don't suffer. And so that's why we try to continue our support at the same level. But I think the current economic situation, far from being kind of a short, transitory, 18-month, two-year downturn, looks like it's going to endure longer, and that'll remain a big challenge.
What gives you most hope at the moment? You mentioned the Philippines, you mentioned Haiti. Other projects, perhaps, were you really excited about what you can do in the future?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what gives me a lot of hope is just seeing God at work. You know, in our own ministry, kind of the remarkable things that sometimes happen. You know, we say at our ministry that our patron saint is Saint Isidore, the farmer who used to go to church every morning and pray and go to Mass and was accused of goofing off from his work. And yet he got more done than anybody because while he was out praying, the angels would plow his fields. And so we often say that we have to put God first and the angels will plow our fields. And remarkable things keep happening. You know, end of last year, a man or a woman, anonymous check for $600,000 came with a check from a bank saying the donor wishes to remain anonymous. And we said, well, the angels are plowing our fields. There's nothing we can do to get that check. We don't even know who to ask. And yet God just provided so that we could do more to help the poor. So those things give me a lot of hope. And then, you know, going overseas and seeing programs like the Bishop Grillon in the Diocese of San Juan de la Maguana in Dominican Republic. We do these huge water projects, you know, put a dam to capture water from a stream up in a mountain, pipe it down 7 or 8 kilometers, to a big tank, distribute it to 20 villages, give every 2,000 families, 3,000 families get water. We've done a number of these big projects. And yet this is a bishop whose plan for his diocese, his pastoral plan, is displayed in a big poster. In the middle of the poster is a crucifix, and around that little crucifix it says Encounter with Christ. And then in the next row is family, individual, retreats. In other words, here is a bishop who sees the mission of the church, beginning with Christ and then branching out to build bridges. I mean, literally, he builds bridges across rivers because the government's too poor to build them. He puts in water supplies, providing water for thousands of people, which saves hundreds and hundreds of lives of children who die from drinking contaminated water. He builds houses. He leads a remarkable transformation of the lives of the poor, and he's a man really centered upon the Lord. And you see the fruit born in his work. So that gives us a lot of hope.
My thanks there to Jim Kavanagh, president of Cross International Catholic Outreach. And if you want to find out more or support the work of Cross International, you can find them on the web at www.crosscatholic.org. For now, that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Don't forget to join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.